Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, if you can hold two thoughts in your mind at the same time, try these two. The United States is not going to hell in a handbasket. American history is full of crises like the ones we're in now, so another renewal is highly likely. And the government is seriously broken. The future depends on fixing it. Those are the two main takeaways for me from a big new article in The Atlantic by national correspondent and former presidential speechwriter James Fallows. Maybe you also saw his contribution to the New York Times piece last week on State of the Union speeches, remembering when he wrote for President Carter that, quote, "There is all across our land a growing sense of peace and a sense of common purpose." I guess a few things have changed since then. James Fallows joins me now. Hi, James. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, very nice to talk to you. Thanks.
And we'll get to your Atlantic article in a minute, but can you reminisce for us about that sunny day State of the Union address in 1978?
Well, the Times had the very interesting idea of rounding up a bunch of people from past administrations and saying, how did things look 1 year in for the Nixon administration, the first Bush administration? So I was doing this for Carter, and as I looked through my notes and looked through the press clips of those days, it was amazing how blessed things seemed for Carter as he got ready for that first speech. And really, the main idea we all had is, gee, things have gone so well this first year. What's on the agenda for year two? And I guess the background point I was trying to convey is, you learn something from the first year, but boy, there's a lot ahead that you can't quite predict. Certainly was the case for Carter, and in ways we don't know for Obama, too.
I guess so. Although one of the things that jumped out at me from your little piece was that Carter said since things were so hunky-dory, he could focus on long-term agenda items to really improve the country. And what were those long-term agenda items? Making government more transparent and reducing the influence of lobbyists. So does that tell us that the more things change, the more they stay the same?
It certainly does. Maybe the seal of the presidency should be Sisyphus pushing his rock up the hill as opposed to this eagle. But yes, it does. That was I guess Carter had come in, as we remember, on a big wave of reform after the Nixon scandals, and so that was his point. In a very different way, Obama came in sort of a moment of national recovery, and so yes, the struggle goes on, as one would say in his speech.
And so, coincidentally, bringing us to the themes of your Atlantic article, wasn't it just about a year later that Carter gave his so-called malaise speech that warned of a historic decline in America?
It was, and it was. hair splitters will note it was about a year and a half later. I make that point because I left shortly before the malaise speech, and my successor, the great New Yorker writer Rick Hertzberg, was on duty for that one. And the interesting thing about that speech is that apart from the fact that Carter didn't say malaise, he was talking about a crisis of confidence, that it was very popular. It was very well received for a couple of days, and then Carter asked all of his cabinet members for their resignation. That added to a certain air of instability, and then things started going further south for him.
And Rick Hertzberg, if you happen to be listening right now, call in, and you and James can talk about writing speeches for Jimmy Carter in different years. All right, you're right in The Atlantic that through your entire conscious life, America has been on the brink of ruination, or so you have heard, from the launch of Sputnik through whatever the latest indication is of national falling apart or falling behind. Polarized politics, failing industries, inconclusive wars. Are you saying this narrative of decline is somehow part of the permanent American psyche?
That was something that historians I spoke with argued to me was the case. And the most charming example is that not long after John Winthrop and his hearty band made it to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they were having these ministers give them Jeremiah sermons about how they'd fallen short of the old ways and God was disappointed in them, and that 1620 it might have been okay, but by 1625 they were really losing that old spirit. So that there is this built into our national political way of doing business of saying, oh, we're really headed for the brink, we're headed for catastrophe, we better change in X and Y and Z ways.
So Americans were always afraid of ruination at every moment in our history, except the 1978 State of the Union address. But what are you saying? In reality, we are so resilient that none of these things matter? That would be kind of Pollyanna and in denial, right?
It would be. It would be. And so, as you very shrewdly pointed out in the intro, there's a split message I'm trying to convey, each half of which I actually mean. On the one hand, coming back as I've been after 3 years away in China, I am much less worried about falling behind the Chinese or America in economic decline or things like that, despite the genuine recession and troubles that we have now, just because there are advantages this country has which you don't notice as clearly until you've been someplace else. And so I feel better about those than I think many people might. On the other hand, the way we have of addressing our public problems looks much worse from afar, and also by historical standards, than I think we realize. Our national government really seems broken in some ways, and I mean that more than just cliche fashion.
Broken how?
Broken in that here I guess would be the main test. If you said there are big problems facing a society or a country or nation, and is a nation able to sort of swing the big howitzer of its national attention to deal with those problems? And that seems to be harder for the U.S. than it has been historically, and that it is other places. And I won't use the example of China, because that's a favorite for showing, oh yes, they can attend to their economic problems, because that's an entirely different and troubled political system of its own. But if you look at the way, for example, the Senate. When the Senate was set up, it was not, number one, there was no filibuster as we have now. And number two, the ratio of big states to small states in the Senate was much closer than it is now. There was basically a 10-to-1 population difference between the biggest and the smallest states when it was set up. Now, as you well know, states like my native California and your state of New York have the same two votes as Wyoming and Nebraska, even though California has almost 70 times more people than Wyoming does. And there's a kind of just brittleness to the political structure which makes it hard to get things done when there is a kind of there's both a supermajority, the filibuster, and this small state misrepresentation which makes it very hard to move things through.
Did you say the filibuster was not an institution when the Senate was first established? Isn't that in the Constitution?
It's not in the Constitution. And this is, thank you for asking this. The Constitution has a few so-called supermajority requirements, like impeaching a president or ratifying treaties and a few other things. But otherwise, the Constitution just provides for majority vote, including in the Senate. And the reason we know the Senate is they say if there's a tie, the vice president can break that tie. But a tie implies a 50-50 or 13-13, as it would have been back when they started the Constitution. So the filibusters became sort of standard practice in the 1800s. But really what we think of as the filibuster today is a phenomenon just of the last 15 or 20 years, essentially where every single important measure every single time needs 60 votes. That is entirely an oddity in American history, and is only the last generation that we've had this.
Would you change the rules?
Yes, I would. And there's a way to do this. At the beginning of each congressional session, that is every 2 years, the Senate can set its rules of operations by majority vote. So a year from now, after the midterms, when the Senate comes together, it could by a 51-to-50 vote or whatever say, okay, our rules of operation for the coming 2 years are it's going to be majority vote. Or they could say it's going to be 55 votes, or they could do whatever they wanted. But they can decide that. And I think that it's our Constitution enshrines the idea of protecting minority interest in various ways. It doesn't enshrine the idea of protecting giving numerical minorities veto power basically on everything, which is the way through custom we've evolved. And I think we see some of that dysfunction now. And I say that whichever party is in control.
And listeners, there may be some things here you want to react to. What do you think of what James Fallows from The Atlantic and Once Upon a Time, Jimmy Carter, speechwriter, is saying here about our system? Both of these two big thoughts to hold in your mind at the same time, both that we have too much declinism in our psyche. We are not probably falling as far behind or falling as much apart as many of us think right now in the current media environment and the current political environment. But at the same time, the government is seriously broken and needs some serious fixes. 212-433-WNYC. for Hendrik Hertzberg and all our other listeners. I don't know if he's listening. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You can give us a call for James Fallows or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. It's funny, though, about the Senate and the filibuster and the relative power of two houses. I mean, from the perspective of a New York Democrat, let's say, during the Bush years, when the House was more radical right and the Senate was seen as kind of the bulwark of moderation, you know, with the finger in the dike from all these right-wing policies that the populist House would have passed and Bush would have signed, then the Senate is seen as this moderate upholder of reason. And then the shoe is on the other foot now in the Obama and Democratic Congress era, and people are like, how can they have this supermajority filibuster in the Senate holding up progress?
Right, and I do recognize that, and I am in favor of this, whoever is in control, but let me suggest this refinement. I think that you could rationally say there are certain kinds of appointments or certain kinds of decisions which are consequential enough that you'll have different sorts of rules. Again, in the Constitution, that's why it was War and Peace back quaintly when the Congress would vote on war, but treaties and impeachment. And I think also you could reasonably say that judicial appointments, since their lifetime and basically not subject to recall in any sort of normal circumstances, would require a supermajority. But when you have doing any kind of business, getting budgets through, although there's some way around that, doing any sort of major legislation requires 60 votes in the Senate, that is a formula for not being able to get things done. Just two other points here. If the way the Senate is apportioned, in theory, you could get the 41 votes necessary to block things with a total of 12% of the U.S. population. Now, if you had the smallest 20 and a half states, that comes to about 12% of the U.S. population. That's not the kind of balance the Constitution had in mind. The other is, if you look at the crisis of California, again, my original home, mm-hmm. Their problem is supermajorities for everything. And the result is just really a collapse of the public ability to do anything. They have ways they can enact benefits, but they can't pass taxes for anything. So I think just as a matter of, I don't think there's any existing test case of legislative systems surviving in the long run with this kind of chronic supermajority business.
Jerry in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah. Good morning. I don't think that the Constitution requires a supermajority to pass legislation, and I think they should do away with the filibuster.
Did you feel that way 4 years ago when Bush had a majority in Congress?
To be honest with you, no, I didn't. But to tell you the truth, I wish that Bush would have been able to pass his legislation so we would know who to blame today without any doubt, and things would be a lot more clear. I regret how I felt before.
Thank you very much. James in Greenpoint, you're on WNYC. Hi, James.
Great. How you doing? The Supreme Court should have at least 30 people so we don't have that thing like we had in Florida. That's my comment. Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Well, that's interesting. How about the number of justices? Have you ever thought about that, James?
Yes. And this is and I thought also about the number of people in the House of Representatives. Just as a side note, the U.S. has about three times as many people as it did a century ago, but they have the same number of representatives in the House. It was increased some before that. So there is, you could argue that various parts of our institution should be adjustable, as our business institutions are, academic institutions, and all the rest. So, yes, having nine justices where one person makes the vote we saw 10 days ago in this Supreme Court decision, you could say there might be, I could see a case for a bigger court.
Ken in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Listen, this issue of the filibuster and waiting for the next Congress to vote on it, they'll never do it. This can be solved next week. That is, on the next bill that the Republicans propose to filibuster on, let them filibuster. And no coffee breaks, no bathroom breaks. They stay on the floor. Believe me, if some of these loudmouth senators dropped on the floor of the Senate, there would be loud cheers from the American public.
Ken, thank you. As Doris Kearns Goodwin was saying the other day on The Daily Show, right? Let them filibuster. She told the story of, I think it was Strom Thurmond, who brought some kind of a steam room onto the Senate floor so he wouldn't have to actually leave the chamber to go to the bathroom, because if he did that, the Democrats could say the filibuster was broken and vote. Does it really work like that?
Well, it did until 1975. Until 1975, filibusters were very rare, and when they happened, they were like Strom Thurmond. And it also took 67 votes to break them. In 1975, there were two changes in the rules. One was to make it 60 votes rather than 67 to stop a filibuster. On the other hand, you had these kind of pretend filibusters that we have now, where you could just say, oh, I'm going to filibuster, and you didn't have to actually do it. And the Senate could proceed with their business. So, as the caller says, that is a possibility. The Democrats could say, okay, you're going to want to stop this appropriations bill, get out there and start talking. So, yes, that is something that could be tried, too.
The other part of that argument from the anti-Republican standpoint is, if they really had to stand up there day after day and make the case against covering more people with health reform, eventually people would get it that they were just wrong and it would work against them. Do you believe that?
I actually don't believe that. I think that I think for the people, by that argument, Fox News would go off the air because people would get tired of that line of argument. I think that there is a sort of self-sustaining line of opposition to health care or whatever other Democratic proposal might be. So I think there are, I'll say one parallel, though. I bet the Republicans won't have a lot more televised Q&A sessions with Obama as they did last week, because I think they recognize that was a better platform for him than for them.
Chris in West Orange is going to defend the filibuster. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just want to call in. I want to make a couple of points. First of all, I don't think the filibuster should be gotten rid of just because it is Senate tradition. I think the real problem is just the civility in Washington. You know, a lot of people forget that the Constitution was really based upon states' rights. You know, some people say federal, other states. But with the expansion of the federal government in recent decades, people forget that the filibuster was presented because each of the states in the United States were essentially their own state, as in like a state system in Europe. You know, England's a state, France is a state. And although, you know, that's changed, especially since Lincoln's time, we still have to keep the essence of that true. Whereas, you know, you said that, you know, it's not right that there's more people in California as opposed to those in South Dakota, yet California has two votes and South Dakota does, but that holds to the essence of the fact that each state is supposed to be an individual state. Now, I agree with you that the House of Representatives should be extended. That, you know, that goes without saying, but the essence of everything is that each state is their own state, and it's more of a, you know, really more of a bottom-up rather than a top-down, you know, federal to state.
Let's get a response because we're running out of time. James Fallows.
Right. And I agree to this extent that everything about the U.S. is a matter of the balance of individual rights, separate state rights, and central rights. My main point in my article is that the balance has changed, that the balance crafted 200-plus years ago was essentially a 10-to-1 offset between populous states like Virginia and small ones like Delaware. They would never have designed it that way if there were a 70-to-1 difference. But it just is kind of an unbalanced structure. So as all of our other institutions adjust, this is the one that's remained rigid, and I think the rigidity is showing.
So in our last minute, to get back to the two thoughts that your article is about, I mean, you emphasize two enduring strengths of the American economy, and they may not be the first two that people would list, but they are immigration and our higher education system. So which is going to win, the foundation or the rot?
Well, I think that what I hope is that the things which make the U.S. attractive as a magnet for talent, the kinds of things that were coming out of our universities, we need to make those as strong and sustainable as they can be. And I hope that being able to focus on our real problem, which is the machinery of government, can at least direct some attention there. So that is my hope as opposed to necessarily my prediction, but that's the best we can do.
James Fallows' cover story in the January-February Atlantic Monthly is How America Can Rise Again. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer in WNYC. Coming up in just a minute, how New York employers are stealing wages from their lowest paid workers. We'll look at the revelations in a new report.